Hi there. I'm Mark Swallow, and I'm glad you are joining me for today's God Is podcast. Let's get started learning who God is.
Thank you for joining me today from wherever you are and by however you listen, as we meet together coast to coast here in the United States and all the way around the world. I'm glad to have you with us. We have under consideration the first of three place names mentioned in Genesis 11, all locations where Abram, his name will be changed to Abraham, and his family lived. The first is Ur of the Chaldeans, the second is Haran, and the third is the land of Canaan. We will come to the second and third of these three soon enough, but I have the most to say about the first, the ancient and well-advanced city of Ur. And we have been outside the scripture, borrowing from the British archaeologist, Sir Leonard Woolley. He died in 1960, but he left us with his books. By the way, what makes him a sir is that he was knighted in 1935 by the King of England. I must say, the British really know how to do it. The titles and the pomp and circumstance of such a ceremony, that big sword swooping down from the queen or king and tapping you on the shoulder. If a man, you are then sir, and if a woman, dame. Well, for his accomplishments in the field of archaeology, he is Sir Leonard Woolley to us. And the reason we are interested in his account of his work at ancient Ur is that he writes about that which Abraham would have seen with his eyes and believed in his heart and mind before God called him to himself and gave him the commission to leave his home in Ur. Here on God Is, we pull on resources that can help us understand the Bible. Woolley does so, as I will now demonstrate for you again today. I remind you that yesterday we talked about how this archaeologist proved the Genesis account of the flood was true. And then we spoke of the ziggurat at Ur and connected that to the Tower of Babel, also written about in Genesis. A ziggurat is an ancient Mesopotamian temple tower consisting of a lofty pyramidal structure built in successive stages with outside staircases and a shrine at the top. And we heard Woolley describe its size and structure. Now listen as he describes the people settling into this area, where Ur was, and what they did to honor their gods when they arrived. Quote, "The people of Ur, their gods are often represented as standing upon mountains and would accordingly be worshipped upon high places. The immigrants to lower Mesopotamia found themselves in a vast level plain, where there was no hill on which God could be properly worshipped, and art, therefore, had to make good the deficiencies of nature. In every town, therefore, which was big enough to warrant the effort, the inhabitants built a high place, a tower rising up in stages and crowned by the town's principal shrine. They used bricks instead of stone and slime, bitumen, had they for mortar, and to their work they would give such a name as the Hill of Heaven, or the Mountain of God. This was the ziggurat." What makes the ziggurat so valuable to understand is the emphasis on worship these pagan people gave there. Ur was a place of full-blown idolatry. It was a sacred city with the massive and towering ziggurat fully dedicated to the moon god and to the supposed wife of the moon god. Their names are Nannar and Ningal, spelled N-I-N-G-A-L. Nannar, spelled N-A-N-N-A-R, is otherwise known as Sin, S-I-N. And isn't that poignantly ironic? It surely was sinful to worship any god other than the only god, as Abram is about to find out. But the people of Ur were so committed to Nannar that their human king was nothing more than a vice-regent of the god, writes Sir Leonard. The ziggurat of Ur was dedicated to Nannar, the patron deity of Ur. They even built a kitchen right into the ziggurat so they could prepare fresh food and bring it up to the god. Nannar, treated as one would a living person, had his house on the summit of the ziggurat, which was dedicated to him. And Woolley says it is possible that his wife, who at Ur was held in very great honor, had her place on the same mountain of God, but at a lower level. They had minor deities as well, and those had a chapel built for them amidst the halls and alleyways of this massive towering structure. In fact, because Nannar was believed to be in total control of Ur, Woolley writes, he controlled its destinies more effectually than did his mortal representative, and he must therefore have his ministers and his court. Nannar was a great landowner and therefore needed stewards to manage his estates. Apart from the high priest and his clerical associates, we read of the sacristan and the choirmaster, the treasurer, the ministers of war and of justice, of agriculture and of housing, a controller of the household, a master of the harem, and directors of livestock, dairy work, fishing, and donkey transport. All these carried on their duties in the temple precincts. Friends, this was Nannar's government, a god who, as we know, never even existed. But what great lengths they went to honoring their god and goddess. As I was reading through his book, Excavations at Ur, I kept thinking, wow, this god is so ingrained in the people of that place. No wonder the faith of Abraham in the God of heaven and earth stood out as remarkable. When we talk about Ur of the Chaldeans, we are talking about a place obsessed with the moon god and his consort. We know that from certain inscriptions discovered in the ziggurat at Ur. A couple of those inscriptions read, "For Nannar, the Lord of Heaven, and for Ningal, his lady." And we can even tell from the cemetery where the king and others were buried in such a way as to honor the moon god. The work that Woolley did in the cemetery and what he found there is fascinating as well. Let me give you just a taste for it, even if this leaves a bad taste in your mouth. When the king died, his entourage were buried alive with him. Woolley describes the scene of the death chambers in his book, writing about them putting the dead king in his tomb and then his still living entourage following him down there, underground, when this happens. Quote, "Each man and woman brought a little cup of clay or stone or metal, the only equipment needed for the rite that was to follow. There would seem to have been some kind of service down there. At least it is certain that the musicians played up to the last. Then each of them drank from their cups a potion which had been brought down with them or found prepared for them on the spot. In one case, we found in the middle of the pit a copper pot into which they could have dipped. And they lay down and composed themselves for death. Someone came down and killed the animals. We found their bones on top of those of the grooms, so they must have died later, and perhaps saw to it that all was decently in order. And when that was done, earth was flung in from above over the unconscious victims, and the filling in of the graved shaft was begun." End quote. Well, it is always telling, based on how someone is buried, what that person or persons, what that culture believes about God and life after death. It must seem to us that it was not a good time to be a friend of the king, or a close advisor for that matter. When he died, your commitment to him was such that you died also. Woolley's shovel sure turned up a lot. And I think this is valuable in the sense that it helps us better understand the universal polytheism, the worship of many gods from which God called Abram to monotheism, the worship of the one true God only. That is what I have wanted to pass along to you from the discipline of archaeology. I know that not all of you are armchair archaeologists, but what I have passed along to you from the real archaeologists, I hope has proved very helpful in supporting what we know about the people we have met and this place Ur. It is extraordinary what we can learn if we open the minds God has given us, and if we feed them. Reading and doing some research in various fields related to theology or related to the Bible is often very profitable. And yet now it is time to reach back into the scripture and to trace a line throughout the Hebrew Bible that connects Ur, very near Babylon, to other references of Babylon and of Chaldea. What we will introduce now and continue tomorrow gives us a big picture perspective as to why Moses pinpoints Abraham as being from Ur of the Chaldeans, which is very near the city of Babylon and within the land we know as the land of the Babylonians. So we will trace these places and the spiritual meaning attached to them in the Hebrew scriptures. And our guides will be Tremper Longman and David Garland, who are the general editors for the Expositor's Bible Commentary. They do as good a job as any I have read in showing us what God is doing by choosing Abraham from this specific geographic location. I credit these men and their useful commentary for these insights, quoting them now. For the author, and by the author, they mean the author of the book of Genesis, Moses. For the author, Ur of the Chaldeans is understood as Babylon. By recounting Abraham's call from Ur of the Chaldeans, the author aims to cast the patriarch as one who came out of Babylon. End quote. You're not going to want to miss this. So I hope you will remember to please be with us tomorrow, as together, you and I, and our friends, continue to discover who God is.
Thank you for listening to this God Is podcast. Drop me an email and tell me what you think. mark@godisministry.org. That's mark@godisministry.org. Please do share this with others, and be sure and join me for the next one.